You're listening to the Darebin Fuse Festival. This five-part podcast series is a collaboration with the First Time Podcast and is part of Darebin's Spring Festival program. Conversations were recorded on the land of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people, and we'd like to acknowledge them as the traditional owners and custodians of the land and pay respects to their elders past, present and future. Episodes in this Fuse series will be released fortnightly and feature local creatives Kate McLennan, Leanne Hall, Eve Reese, Clementine Ford, and McKinley Valentine. Happy listening. Clementine Ford is a writer, broadcaster, feminist commentator, and public speaker based in Melbourne. She has published two best-selling non-fiction works, Fight Like a Girl and Boys Will Be Boys. Clementine Ford, let's start at the very beginning. Have you always wanted to be a writer?
Oh, gosh. It was one of the jobs that I always dreamed of doing, you know, primarily because I think before I became a writer, I imagined it as being a lot more glamorous than it actually is. You know, and I said the other day in something that I wrote that I always used to think I wanted to be a lawyer as well, and then I realised I just wanted to play one on television. So I think in some ways my desire to be a writer was driven more probably by the kinds of writers that I saw in the TV shows and the movies that I loved. And I was less prepared for the reality of it, which is, you know, a lot of sitting around and writing in your pajamas, feeling disgusting, and also hating yourself constantly.
Oh, great. Well, we can get more into that. do you remember the first thing that you ever had published?
It's tricky. It depends on how you define that, I guess, because I worked at the student newspaper when I was at Adelaide University, and I, you know, I like to say that I did a double major in English and gender studies, but that I really excelled in student media because I spent all of my time down in the student media, in the student newspaper office, and none of my time at lectures or doing my schoolwork. So the first thing I got published that I was the proudest of, weirdly, was in my first year of university. In fact, it was the first week at university, and I'd read an article in the student newspaper on D, which I didn't have anything to do with at the time, obviously. And I kind of got a little bit outraged by what they were suggesting. I was being very earnest about the whole thing. I think they'd written an article about freshers, and, you know, I decided that I was going to be my usual teacher's pet and respond. And so I wrote a letter to the student newspaper and they published it. And I remember thinking, like, it's, you think of it now and you're like, well, that's just a letter to a student newspaper. But it was one of the proudest things I've ever been able to bring home. And I, you know, took the newspaper home and I showed it to my mum and I said, look, I've had my letter published in the student newspaper. And I think she cut it out and pinned it up on the fridge. And I mean, I was 17 years old. But it was amazing to see that you could, it was the first experience I'd really had that you could express and articulate an opinion to people who weren't obliged to read it and have them acknowledge it. And not only acknowledge it, but share that opinion with other people, whether or not they agreed with it. Of course, when I became, you know, a member of the student newspaper myself, I realized that you're battling constantly for content. So you pretty much publish anything that comes your way that's halfway decently written. But, you know, at the time I was extremely proud.
Oh, that's a great moment. So you went on from student newspapers to many other newspapers. You've also written two books. You have such a strong and distinct voice in your writing. Was that always the case? Was it evident in that first letter to the editor?
I think that I've always had a strong, what is, you know, kindly referred to in women as a strong personality, which often, as you know, just means that we are bolshy, and another word that's only used for women, by the way, and opinionated, also a word that's reserved for women. So I've always had it in me, thankfully, gratifyingly. But like anyone, you know, I didn't, this is the problem with writing is that I think that, or well, with people who want to become writers, or who are writers in some way but aren't yet practiced and trained as a writer, is that obviously we know that a portion of being able to write comes from raw talent, and the raw talent is often what defines, and I'm not saying that I have that raw talent, but it's the raw talent is often what defines an exceptional writer from a good writer. But there are other things as well that people don't necessarily take into account, which is just tenacity and discipline and exercising your writing muscles. So you can want to be a writer and you can have good ideas and you can even have the raw talent, but you still need to sit down and train every day and you need to exercise your muscles every day. So the writer that I am today, I think, is a very different writer to the one I was even 1 year ago. It's a different writer to the one when I was writing my second book, which was different to the writer I was when I was writing my first book. And I hopefully am continuing to grow and evolve and exercise my writing muscles and continually improve, because I don't see writing as a discipline as being something that you can, you know, you can reach a state and go, right, well, I've done it now. Now I've achieved the black belt. So when I was writing it, you know, for the student newspaper, it was an excellent training ground. And it was, you know, it was a huge privilege in lots of ways as well, because it was pre-internet. And so nothing that you wrote then, no ill-formed opinion or poorly expressed idea could possibly be shared with millions of people and have you instantly dragged and cancelled all across the internet, fortunately. So I was able to, I guess, begin to exercise those muscles in a crude way. And then when I left university, I didn't expect that writing would be a career that I could take with me. You know, so I was temping. I was still really trying to figure out what it was that I wanted to do and what I could do with my life. It seemed apparent to me that I was no good at office work because I continued to be fired from every job that I ever got. Mainly because I really liked writing in all of the spare time that I had at work. So I kind of stumbled into professional writing in that I was writing a blog, which everyone was doing in 2005, and it just so happened that the editor of the Sunday Mail at the time, because I was living in Adelaide, and the editor of the Sunday Mail was not as conservative as the paper itself, and he really wanted to get a vibrant young female voice in that would kind of shake up some of the readership. And someone sent him, you know, one of my blog entries, and I got an email out of the blue from him saying that, you know, he wanted me to come in and have a chat. And it was really kind of like a total mind-blowing experience. And I sort of, that kind of began it. Now, after I wrote for the Sunday Mail for a couple of years, and I experienced the hubris of success or moderate success that many of us do in our 20s, where you are waiting for the crash to occur. And the crash did occur. And I lost my column there when the editors changed and the new editor wasn't such a fan of my strident voice. And so I really had to start again from the ground up. And it was easy when you're, you know, it's easy in a place like Adelaide where you can kind of be a big fish in a small pond. And so once I kind of had that or suffered that setback or had a rude, you know, awakening and a reality check, I then had to kind of go back to the drawing board and say, okay, what is it that I want to do? How do I want to achieve it? What is available to me in the professional writing sphere at the moment that I can use to my advantage? And that's sort of what I did. I did a lot of writing for free. I flew myself interstate to Melbourne and Sydney, where everything was happening at the time. I flew myself interstate at my own expense often to go and speak at events for free, because I thought at the time, and I still strongly believe this, I believe that writers should be paid for their work, as all artists and creatives should, especially if they're making money for other people. But I also think that if you want to be a successful writer in today's climate, particularly if you're writing, you know, commentary for cash, you have to invest in yourself as if you were a small business, and every small business loses money in the first year.
That's a really great way of putting it, because that's such a hot debate, isn't it, about whether or not people should be paid for the work that they do. But that's a different take.
And of course they should be paid for the work that they do. I'd like to reiterate that if it's a big website, you know, at the time, I won't name names, but I'm sure people can figure out who I'm talking about. At the time, there was a big website primarily focused at women, and it still exists, and it didn't pay its writers at the time, and it was making a lot of money out of the content that was being produced for it. Now, I think that that is clearly wrong, whether or not you are a writer of 10 years experience or it's your first piece. If you're making money for someone else, they should pay you for it. But if it's a case of like, well, this small collective is putting on an event and they don't have a budget because they're a small collective, and they've asked me if I could speak there, well, I'll invest in that, because If I fly myself there, if I spend $500 on that weekend, but I meet three people who know my name now, who are in a position later on to give me work, then that's an investment. And that's how I always saw it. Not everyone will agree with that, and not everyone will feel like there's value in that. But for me personally, I did see that there was value, and I saw the payoff of that investment too.
Mm. So you are a writer. You're obviously also an activist. I'm interested in understanding how you think about your audience. Do you think about your audience? Do you see them as people that agree or disagree?
I do think about my audience. I don't know that I would necessarily claim the title of activist for myself, even though I think that some of my work is definitely activism. And the only reason that I distance myself from that label is not because I'm ashamed of it. It's because I maybe it's imposter syndrome. I don't feel qualified enough in activism to be able to really, like, assume the privilege of battle. I'm working, you know, all over the world today, but in Australia, we're talking about that context. So in Australia today, whose output and devotion to activism is so admirable. And to put myself in there in that same league, it doesn't feel right to me. I write about things that I care about. Obviously, some of those issues are prevalent in activist circles, but I also, you know, I also enjoy making makeup videos, and that is a form of activism in a way. But I don't know, so that I would. I guess I prefer. I feel more comfortable saying, well, I'm a writer, and I also, you know, I kind of like to build community amongst women who are drawn to the communities that I want to build, and in that sense, make some kind of difference or impact. But, you know, especially as I get older, I think I'm a lot more flexible in the way that I think about how these things can be done, and I'm less dogmatic in a way. And I was very dogmatic in my 20s, and dogmatic people achieve a lot, and I think that they you know, again, like, I have a huge admiration for them. I just don't have the energy for it anymore, and I don't have the, I kind of feel like I'm, you know, I've been being a strident feminist for professionally for 14 years, and I'm okay with taking a step back from that and doing some different things, and seeing what exciting new voices are out there that can occupy that space and are occupying that space, I should say.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. Thinking about looking at your work historically, I guess, a critique of it, and a critique, I think, of feminist writing in general, is that it's angry. But to me, one of the things that's supremely undersold is the humour in your writing, which I sort of see as a direction you seem to be heading towards, looking at some of the Instagram stories. Like, I look at the beaches and the Carrie Bradshaw sort of stuff. I mean, there's always elements that are kind of, even historically, that shocking funny. Is that something that resonates with you?
Definitely. I mean, well, the first thing I would say as well is that, of course, feminists and feminist activism and feminist writing, any expression of feminism, and even if you remove feminism from the equation, any expression of women expressing an opinion at all that disagrees with patriarchal impact is always framed as being angry, because the worst thing in the world is an angry woman. Angry women are ugly, and angry women are unpleasant, and women should be pleasant all the time. So, of course, we're framed as angry. But the other thing I would say is, like, who cares if we're angry? We should be angry. More women should feel free to embrace and express their anger. Men are allowed to be angry all the time. Anger is, like, one of the only emotions allowed to men. And I don't see why it's, like, we have to resist the pathologization of anger in women. So when people say to us, oh, you're very angry, we should be less inclined to try and argue our way against that accusation and try and convince them, or, you know, try and dissuade them of that view, and say, yes, I am f***ing angry. I've got a lot to be angry about. Women have a lot to be angry about. You know, if you're not angry, then you're not paying attention. And if you expect me not to be angry at the way that we're all treated, then you clearly don't respect women. If you're not angry about it, then you don't respect women. So, like, obviously I am an angry person. I have reason to be angry, but you know, anger is also seen as this incredibly one-dimensional thing, that if you're angry, you can't also have all of these nuances and complexities, or that your anger itself cannot be funny or cannot be framed in a humorous way. And I do think that I'm a funny person, and I appreciate that you say that. And actually, a lot of people kind of almost in surprise say to me, I read your book and, you know, I was expecting to feel one way about it, but I didn't expect to laugh so much. Mm. And I always find that really funny because I think in person I'm quite I feel like I bring a lot of levity to situations because that's the best way to convince people, is to make them laugh as you're punching them in the stomach.
You've had some horrendous experiences online, which we don't need to go into. But one of the approaches that you take now is about highlighting and showcasing and sort of naming and shaming what people do. When you were deciding to adopt that approach, what was the internal debate like in your head?
Oh, there was no internal debate.
Right.
I've always shared the abusive messages that people send to me, that men send to me in particular, the abusive anti-feminist, violent, you know, the fantasies of degradation, or just the sort of basic kind of, you know, dismissive swearing at you, calling you ugly, fat, all those sorts. I don't know if you're going to bleep that out, but I mean, that's the reality. That's what women get on the internet. So I've always shared it, and I share it. I never even sat down and thought, well, what will be the consequences for me? I just, you know, in lots of ways, I'm an enormously privileged person. And one of the ways in which I'm privileged is that I didn't grow up in a family that, firstly, my family was not extremely left wing. I didn't grow up in a culture of feminism or social justice. So that was all stuff that I was privileged to learn from activists later on. But what I did grow up with was a family that, despite that, very strongly believed in women's rights to speak up. You know, it was a very kind of like big L liberal feminist approach, I suppose, in that, you know, they believed that, neoliberal, I suppose, that my daughters should be able to go out and do and achieve whatever they want. And, you know, what my dad and I very publicly disagree on lots of things political. But he's always said, you know, I raised my children to express themselves and to not feel afraid of expressing their opinions. And that's what has happened. Mm. And my mother, of course, was like that too. So unlike a lot of women, I didn't grow up in an extremely hostile home. There were obviously hostilities and there were gender inequalities, but I didn't come home every day to a family that dismissed my view of women's rights, or dismissed, even if they didn't agree with it all the time, I was never told that I was ridiculous or I was overreacting or that I was, you know, that women belonged in the kitchen, even though sometimes my sister and I were definitely expected to do all the kitchen work. So I have that privilege of kind of coming to this public space already believing that my voice deserves to be heard. Hmm. And being screamed at in ways that I wasn't familiar with was almost, it's never really been upsetting to me. It's just been bizarre. It's been odd. It's like dealing with people who are, you know, who come from a different planet. So showing it to people is not only a way of saying this is the reality of what happens when women use their voices in public and in private, but also let's laugh at it. Let's have a laugh about it. Like I don't think I've ever, my motivation has never been to people. Some people would definitely disagree with this, but I can honestly say my motivation has never been to garner sympathy for myself. It's only ever been to, you know, cast a light on it, because a lot of women I know absorb it and they feel chastened by it and they feel chastised, and what they end up doing is silencing themselves. They remove themselves from the situation. And I've kind of always been, might surprise you to learn this, a very combative person. And so I was just like, well, I'm not going to be cowed into silence. I'm not going to take this hit privately. I'm going to show everyone in your community what you think, and I'm going to show people who don't know you what you think, and I'm going to attach your name to it. And it's been very effective. And, you know, I'm not obviously not the only person who does that. But one of the ways that I'm trying to do it now is that I, on Instagram, when I get messages like that, I mock it up into like a little inspirational quote sort of format. You know, again, I'm not the first person who's used that method, but it's another way of injecting that humor into it.
Yeah. It's very, it takes back power too, doesn't it?
Sure. And I think that one of the things that keeps women silent, I mean, we can obviously acknowledge the reality of the threat of physical violence and the threat to our safety if we are in actual real life situations and we speak up and we object to the way that we're being treated. Of course, we have to be careful. But, and I'm not saying that you don't need to be careful online, because there are methods that people, if they want to try hard enough, can use to hurt you. But most of the people, in my experience and in my assessment, most of the people who send you abuse online, they're not even proactive enough to turn up to my events and scream it at my face. You know, half of them don't even live in the same country as you. So this is a way of saying, well, I have power in this situation. I'm not going to let you silence me in the way that I already feel silent in lots of other areas of my life. You know, a lot of women, I also have the luxury of being, that's my workspace, and I can go to work and be abused at work and I can yell and scream about it. Whereas a lot of other women go to work and they're subjected to sexism or, you know, outright abuse sometimes, but sometimes just benign sexism. And it, you know, it might come from men that they work for, and they can't speak up about it. And that contributes to their level of frustration. So if, in some ways, I also think that seeing other women speak out against it in their workspace can be liberating or cathartic.
I think there's a lot of truth in that. I think one of the things that's really hopeful about your work is the emphasis that you put on relationships and friendships between women. So sort of on that topic, can we talk about your Instagram stories that we've mentioned?
Sure.
How did they come about?
Okay, so for people who aren't familiar with my Instagram, which is primarily the social media platform that I use these days, every Sunday now, pretty much through most of lockdown and most of stage three in Melbourne, every Sunday I do a deep dive into a movie from the 80s or the 90s, you know, a classic that we all love. And I explore them from a feminist perspective in what I think is a very funny way, but also in a sort of a serious and sociological sense too. Most of the films that I've looked at or the TV series I've looked at have been in a kind of, I've taken a feminist stance on saying these are actually all the ways in which the messaging in this movie is really bad. But some of them I've, you know, done as celebrations. And I've, you know, anyone who's kind of read my books or who's familiar with me will know that Beaches is one of my favourite movies. I think it's exceptional. I think it's a beautiful depiction of, you know, the most important relationship that most women will ever have, which is with another woman, their soulmate, their lifeblood. And of course, because it's a movie for women that showcases women and that celebrates women's friendship, it's always been derided in pop culture. And it's always been treated as ridiculous. And, you know, Bette Midler, her entire, you know, progressive history and the incredible space that she takes in musical history and in pop culture and in queer culture is eradicated because people associate The Wind Beneath My Wings with Beaches, which is a hated movie. So one of the deep dives that I did was into Beaches, and I sort of like branched out from that and talked about the importance and power of female friendship, which is something that all of us, or most of us who are women, are lucky to feel, but we're also told isn't really that important. And so I use Instagram to kind of explore those ideas, because I actually think, you know, this kind of goes back to something you said before about being an activist, which, like I said, I don't call myself an activist. But one of the things that I find really accessible about Instagram in terms of community building is that obviously it's a platform, from my experience, that's primarily used by women. It's been, in my experience, a primarily positive space. And it's one in which women can indulge in their enjoyments of things that we've always been told are frivolous. We're also told that we need to aspire to, but when we do aspire to them, things like beauty or makeup or appearance, when we do aspire to them and enjoy them, then we're called frivolous and ridiculous. That we can do all of that, but we can also be incredibly political. So I see there's a lot of nuance in that space that is unrecognized and dismissed. And one of the things that I like about it is that it's, for me, it's kind of like a virtual hairdressing salon or a beauty salon. And again, the beauty salon, the town beauty salon, has always been dismissed as a place of meaninglessness because it's women who populate it. But it's in the beauty salon that women who don't have access to academic feminism or don't have access to, you know, the time or the finances that are needed to kind of explore a lot of the impact of patriarchy on their life can still have very candid conversations about the way that their partners are treating them, for example, or what it's been like to be a mother, or, you know, the sexism that they experience at work. So for me, Instagram has almost become like a virtual beauty salon in which all of these incredibly political conversations between women actually occur, but the veneer of it is dismissed by everyone looking in, which is actually great because it means you can do a lot of organizing.
Yeah, that's fascinating. It's, I mean, even without looking into it so deeply, it is just a kinder space, which sort of works to that effect as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it's one in which, you know, I recently unpublished my public Facebook page, and I don't know whether or not I'll republish it again. I'm not sure. It was no longer sparking joy. to me, it felt like a very combative space, not in that there was a robust exchange of opinions going on, but that Facebook itself at the moment, you know, and Twitter I got rid of ages ago because that's just a toxic hellhole. It just feels like everyone's primed for a fight all the time. And there are times in which we do have to be primed for fighting and where that is really important, but we can't be primed to fight constantly because not only, well, in my case, it leads me to make bad decisions. It's incredibly stressful. I feel like when I'm in those spaces, I'm constantly in a state of high adrenaline, which has a physical impact on my health and well-being. But I just also don't know, for me, like how productive it is. It's not productive to have, it's not productive when you're trying to kind of engage in feminist practice and in feminist and exchange feminist ideas with women from all different backgrounds, to constantly having to be fielding either abuse from men or sneering attitudes from incredibly academic feminists who think that the way that you're going about things is, you know, conforming to the patriarchy. It's like, that's fine, you can think that, but do we want to have, do we want to make feminism accessible to more women and to all women by taking it to the spaces that they're in and taking it to the issues that they care about and making those things feminist? Or do we want to like gatekeep to the point where a lot of women feel intimidated to even get involved?
Let's talk about advice for other writers. I feel like there's always a bit of a salve in hearing other people's rejection stories or heartbreaking reviews. Anything crushing that you are willing to share?
Oh, I mean, so many things, so many crushing things. I think it was Benjamin Law who once pointed out that the most diabolical thing you could do to someone if you were trying to hurt them was to leave them a 2-star review instead of a 1-star review. Because 1-star you can just dismiss and say, well, this person just hates me. But 2-star implies that they weren't coming from a personal place of dislike. I actually genuinely try not to read reviews because, you know, that way lie monsters. And you can, people may not believe this about myself, but about me, but I don't Google myself. I don't Twitter search myself. I'm not interested in, you know, in kind of poking my tongue into the mouth ulcer. I know that people out there hate me. I know what they think of me, and I don't need to necessarily read all of the words. You know, in terms of like professional rejections, I think that people make the mistake of thinking that if they look at someone now and they see a success, they trace it back to the moment that they first became aware of that person as a successful person. And they think that that is the extent of the time and the effort and the work that went into creating that name and that platform and that career.
The overnight success.
And they don't see the many, many years of, you know, as I said before, of losing money, of waitressing, of writing in cafes in between your shifts, of trying to get people to pay attention to you, and of just basically plugging away that goes into, you know, climbing that mountain. They just see someone standing on some ledge on the mountain and they're like, well, how did they get up there? And you're like, well, you know, there's a maelstrom of different things that contribute to someone's success. And in my case, You know, I read Bree Lee talk about it recently. I thought that she put it really well, where she acknowledged that she had an enormous amount of privilege, but that she also worked hard, but that having the privilege made the hard work. Mm. Like, it was a privilege in her case that the hard work could have a certain degree of payoff because of that privilege. So there's a whole mess of things, obviously, that go into it. But, you know, it's not like you just, with the rare exception of someone like a Zadie Smith, who's such a phenom, who wrote White Teeth at 24 and seemed to become an overnight success. But then, even then, I don't know how many years before that Zadie Smith was scribbling in her notebooks or trying to meet people, trying to get her work paid attention to, or how hard she'd studied. Like, there are all of these stories that people don't see. They want to know how to get to where you are, but if you tell them it's going to take you years and you're going to be rejected and you're going to be upset and you will be treated unfairly, and also, by the way, you have to write every day and you have to accept that the writer that you are now is not great and the writer that you will be in 5 years is 10 times better than the writer you are now if you practice. Like, that doesn't sound as appealing as,
no, it doesn't,
well,
does it?
You know, just go and get your first book deal. I mean, I got my first book deal in 2015, and I'd been writing for almost 10 years as a public feminist. And I also had almost gotten a book deal in 2012 or 2013, but it went to acquisitions, and, you know, I'd gotten my hopes up and it went to acquisitions, and then acquisitions decided, I won't name the publisher because I hope they're kicking themselves now. But actually they were right, because the response that I got was, well, feminism just doesn't sell. Feminist books don't sell, which actually it was true in 2012 and 2013. And I didn't have the name then that would have carried the book that I ended up writing. And I didn't have the experience, and I didn't have the writing experience, and I didn't have the life experience. So even though it was a crushing rejection, I also didn't say, well, that, then I'm giving up. And I just kept trying, and I kept waitressing, and I kept doing odd jobs and, you know, trying to like cobble together my rent every week or every month. And then as my writing profile grew and my voice became more assured, and I was more certain of who I was and what I wanted to say, then I was able to go back and try again. And I'm so grateful, actually, for that rejection early on, because I think if I'd published a book then, and it probably would have sunk without a trace, and no one would have taken a risk on me again.
Yeah, there's something, I think we always want things too early sometimes, before we're actually ready. Like, retrospectively, you can often look back at those near misses and actually feel very grateful that they were near misses, and you know.
Yeah, and I think that you can, in wanting that, in being so hungry for it, you have to kind of, a piece of advice I would give to your listeners is to really sit down and be honest with themselves about what it is they're hungry for. Are they hungry for a perception of fame? Are they hungry for the idea of going to literary events or of having professional respect? I mean, I don't necessarily think that I have a lot of professional respect. I think that I could be, maybe this is my own imposter syndrome still talking, you know, and of course I still have it. I've written 2 best-selling books and I still have imposter syndrome. But I often feel like, because my work is accessible, that the accessibility of it means that some people have decided that it's not really that smart or clever. And, you know, that's fine. They're entitled to their view. But I think that it's deceptively clever to write something accessible that also disseminates, like, quite sophisticated ideas that people maybe have never heard of before or haven't felt able to, like, apply to themselves. So you have to figure out what it is that you're hungry for. And certainly when I was, you know, when I was pitching that book the first time, and when I was trying to be, it's always easy when you've kind of achieved a certain degree of success to say, well, you need to be patient. But there is some truth to it, that when I was desperate for it, when I was really hungry for it, I probably was not motivated by the desire to actually contribute something of value or meaning. What I was motivated by, I think, was the desire to be seen as someone who contributed value and meaning, and to be kind of to achieve a point of success where I could stop trying so hard to get there.
Interesting. How has COVID impacted on your writing routine or your work?
There's 2 different answers to that. So COVID has impacted on my work in general by forcing me to be extremely creative about the work that I do. So one of the things that I've been doing are those deep dives. And, you know, a lot of people might be like, well, what are you talking about? That's not work. And sure, it's not work. It's not like going out and, you know, building wells somewhere, or I'm not a health worker or anything like that. But it is providing content and entertainment in exactly the same way that a more formal website does those things. And a more formal website is able to place advertisements on their products. I just happen to be doing it all myself, and I am the product. So I've been able to kind of explore different sides of myself, the more humorous things, the more creative things, which I'm so grateful for, because I actually do feel like quite a creative person. But for a long time, because I was just writing op-ed, and I was not stuck in a rut, but I knew what the brand was that people wanted from me, or I knew what the brand was that editors wanted from me. And you sort of end up boxed into this corner where it's not surprising to me that people think, oh, you're just this one kind of person, you know. And then now one of the things that a lot of my audience, if you want to call it that, are saying is, you know, it's so nice to get to know other sides of you, or it's so nice to kind of like see this lighter part of you, or to see how I am with my son, even though I don't really incorporate him into my social media or anything like that. So I've been doing that, and that's been really a great way to kind of explore what work in these times can look like for creative people. If you want to sort of be a content maker, or, you know, I feel like when I say that, I'm saying it sort of with an air of cynicism or derision, because that's what I assume people think of the words content creator. But actually, we need to accept the fact that particularly over the last 100 years, industries have been rapidly changing and adapting to technologies, that content creator is as legitimate as a job as online, you know, commentator or like opinion writer or whatever. And like I said, you can actually translate a lot of the same ideas that I was talking about in 800 words. You can do it in an Instagram story about a movie. You know, one of the things that I'm passionate about at the moment, a more serious topic, is birth trauma and birth injuries. And I've been able to really connect with people who've experienced both of those things by using a platform like Instagram, and using it to share my own experiences. So that's been really great. In terms of the writing, it's been a disaster, because I'm at home, you know, 5 days a week with my 4-year-old. And then on the weekends, he goes to his dad's house. And I'm really grateful for that. Grateful. I don't want to use the word grateful, because his father is fathering. I'm glad for myself that I chose to have a baby, or I was able to have a baby, with someone who was enthusiastic about performing his equal share of parenting. But then I get to the weekends and I have all this other work to catch up on. You know, I make a podcast, which has been really great to do in lockdown and isolation, but then I have to do all the editing on, well, I mean, you know what it's like. So I feel constantly busy and constantly kind of under the pump. And unfortunately, I have a book due, and I'm finding it very difficult to find time to write it.
Is this a third in the Fight Like a Girl, Boys Will Be Boys? Is it part of a trilogy or a companion?
It's not part of a trilogy. No, it's very different in lots of ways, actually. It was meant to come out in October this year, but I've fortunately been bought a little bit of time because we have a global pandemic. So it's coming out next October. It's called How We Love, and it's a book of essays, memoir, really not about, like, not just about romantic love, but about my own experiences with the nature of love. So one of my essays is about my mother and, you know, the experience of watching her die from a terminal illness, and, you know, kind of goes into my history with her and my past with her and, you know, me as a child. And then another essay is about becoming a mother myself and how that reframed what love looked like in my mind. And, you know, and then there's some about romantic love. And then one essay is actually about bodies, but not in terms of, you know, like self-love and learning how to love your body, but actually in terms of the aging process and how it feels to be approaching 40 and all of the feminist values that you thought you had in your 20s about never letting those concerns be a part of your life are suddenly not only very present in your life, but you also have a little bit of money to do something about them. So what does it mean to be able to physically change the way that you look or the way that you to physically inhabit a kind of quote unquote femininity that you always felt was really distant to you, or that you were you weren't entitled to kind of occupy. And one of the things I talk about a lot on Instagram now actually is that, you know, when I was younger, I really felt, and I wrote about this in Fight Like a Girl, I really felt very excluded from the status of girlhood, even though I loved everything that was quintessentially and stereotypically girly and feminine. And it always felt to me like this was this huge joke that I could love these things when clearly they weren't for me. And so a part of that essay as well is about kind of exploring what it is that femininity means, why it's so derided, why we're taught to view it as something ridiculous. And also what, you know, is there something political, or is this just something that I'm reaching for to justify my own decisions? Is there something political in being able to marry the power that you have as an older woman and the internal power and the confidence that you've finally been able to sort of access and the sort of give no f***s attitude with the power that we are taught to physically ascribe to as younger women, you know, the power of physicality, that if you can somehow marry the two of those, will it, how will it change the way that you view yourself? Or is it just vanity, you know? But so that's probably the most feminist of the essays. But it's a different, it's a really different perspective to me than people will be used to, which is very scary because I know that if I just were to write another kind of funny, ranty, angry feminist book that, you know, there's a huge audience for that. People love that stuff now. It's very different to 2013. So this is taking a big risk, and that's actually really great because as writers, we should always take risks and we should always be prepared to do things that are scary.
I was going to ask for a final note of advice for emerging writers. That might be it. Is there anything you'd add?
I suppose I've kind of covered a lot of bits of advice throughout our conversation today. The one thing that I would reiterate, I guess, is that part of the discipline of practicing writing, whether or not it's every day or whether or not it's a few times a week, and practicing it for yourself in a way that not necessarily anyone else will read. I mean, that's free labor too. If you want to talk about writing for free, except it's not, because it's investing in your own skill and your own craft, is in committing yourself to that discipline, not only do you technically become a better writer through practice, but you are also able to have a conversation with yourself in a way that allows you to understand yourself more and to see yourself as an entity that you may not know everything about yet. And so it's a way of forming a relationship with yourself that unfolds over time and that is illuminating and that will tell you things about yourself that you didn't realize were there and that will teach you what it is you're passionate about and what you want your craft to commit itself to and to devote itself to. And that is why it's so important to practice it constantly, because until you know who you are, you can't possibly know what it is you want to write about.
You can find the show notes for this episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. If you're feeling so inclined, we would love for you to leave us a review wherever you listen. This helps other people find us.
Get in touch with us via the contact page on our website or connect with the entire First Time gang on Twitter or Instagram at The First Time Pod. And don't forget, you can support us via Patreon. Go to patreon.com/thefirsttimepodcast. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We recorded this episode at Kathleen Syme Library on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. The First Time Podcast is produced by Phoebe 80 and supported by Writers Victoria, the ACT Writers Centre, and our wonderful patrons.